I'm beginning to like you, Tim from Ohio. She polished off her drink and set it aside. As for me, I'm really here to form a philosophy of life. An expensive way to do it, but it seemed like a good idea at the time, and I've decided to go with it. This luxurious ambition, 4 years of college at 23 grand a pop to amass a personality, struck me as another alien aspect of her that I was hoping to learn more about. I say alien, but what I mean is angelic. By this point, I was utterly convinced that she was a creature of the spheres. You don't approve? Something in my face must have said so. I felt my cheeks grow warm. I didn't say that. You didn't say anything. Piece of advice. That man that hath a tongue, I say, is no man, if with his tongue he cannot win a woman. I'm sorry? Shakespeare, Two Gentlemen of Verona. In plain English, when a woman asks you a question, you better answer. If you want to get her into bed, Lear added. He looked at me. You'll have to excuse her. She's like the Shakespeare Channel. I don't understand half the things she says. I knew almost nothing about Shakespeare. My experience of the bard was limited, like many people's, to a dutiful slog through Julius Caesar, violent, occasionally exciting, and Romeo and Juliet, which until that moment I'd found patently ridiculous. I just meant I've never met anybody who thinks that way. She laughed. Well, if you want to hang around with me, bub, better bone up. And with that, she said, rising from the bed. And speaking of which, I must be off. But you're not half as drunk as we are, Lear protested. I was hoping to have my way with you. Weren't you just? At the doorway, she looked back at me. I forgot to ask. Which are you? One more question I had no answer for. Come again? Fly? Owl? A.D.? Tell me you're not Porcellian. Lear answered in my stead. Actually, our boy here, though technically a junior, has yet to experience this aspect of Harvard life. It's a complicated story I'm much too drunk to explain. So you're not in a club? She said to me. There are clubs. Final clubs. Somebody pinch me. You really don't know what they are. I had heard the term, but that was all. Are they some kind of fraternity? Not exactly, Lear said. What they are, Liz explained, are anachronistic dinosaurs, elitist to the core, which also happen to throw the best parties. Jonas is in the Spee Club, like his daddy, and his daddy's daddy, and all the Lear daddies since fish grew legs. He's also the, what do you call it? Jonas, what do you call it? The Punch Master. She rolled her eyes. And what a title that is. Basically, it means he's in charge of who gets in. Honey Bunch, do something. I only just met the guy. Maybe he's not interested. Sure I am, I said, though I wasn't sure at all. What was I letting myself in for? And what did something like that cost? But if it meant spending more time in Liz's company, I would have walked through fire. Absolutely. I'd definitely be interested in something like that. Good. She smiled victoriously. Saturday night, black tie. See, Jonas? It's settled. I had no doubt that it was. The first problem. I didn't own a tuxedo. I had worn one once in my life, a powder blue rental with navy velvet accents, paired with a ruffled shirt that only a pirate could have loved, and a clip-on bow tie fat as a fist. Perfect for the island-themed senior prom at Mercy Regional High School, a night in paradise, but not the rarefied chambers of the Spee Club. I intended to rent one, but Jonas convinced me otherwise. Your tuxedo life, he explained, has only just begun. What you need, my friend, is a battle tux. The shop he took me to was called Keezer's, which specialized in recycled formal wear cheap enough to vomit on without compunction. A vast room, unfancy as a bus station, with moth-eaten animal heads on the walls and air so choked with naphthalene it made my sinuses sting. From its voluminous racks I selected a plain black tux, a pleated shirt with yellow stains under the arms, a box of cheap studs and cufflinks, and patent leather dress shoes that hurt only when I walked or stood. In the days leading up to the party, Jonas had adopted a persona that was somewhere between a wise young uncle and a guide dog for the blind. The selection of the tux was mine, but he insisted on choosing my tie and cummerbund, examining dozens before settling on pink silk with a pattern of tiny green diamonds. Pink? Needless to say, it wasn't anything that would have flown in Mercy, Ohio. A powder blue tux, yes. A pink tie, no. Are you sure about this? Trust me, he said. It's the kind of thing we do. The party, as I understood it, would be a sort of elaborate first date. Members would have the chance to look over fresh prospects, called punchees. I was worried that I didn't have anyone to bring, but Jonas assured me that I was better off alone. That way, he explained, I would have the opportunity to impress the flotilla of unescorted women imported for the occasion from other colleges. Get two of them into bed and you're definitely in. I laughed at the absurdity. Why only two? I mean, at the same time, he said. I had not seen Liz since my first day in Winthrop House. This did not seem strange to me, as she lived in Mather, far down the river, and moved in an artsier crowd. I had, however, through discreet, well-spaced questioning, managed to learn more about her connection to Jonas. They were not, in fact, a strictly Harvard couple, but had known each other since childhood. Their fathers had been prep school roommates, and the two families had vacationed together for years. This made sense to me. In hindsight, their verbal jousting had sounded as much like an exchange between two precocious siblings as a romantic twosomes. Jonas claimed that for many years they actually couldn't stand each other. It wasn't until they were 15 and forced to endure two foggy weeks with their parents on a remote island off the coast of Maine that their mutual antipathy had boiled over into what it really was. They'd kept this from their families. Even Jonas confessed that there was something vaguely incestuous about the whole thing, confining their passions to secret summertime trysts in barns and boathouses while their parents got drunk on the patio, not really thinking of themselves as boyfriend-girlfriend until they'd both wound up at Harvard and discovered that they actually liked each other after all. This account also explained, at least partly, the oddness of their relationship. What else but shared history could bond two people who possessed such fundamentally incompatible temperaments, such divergent visions of life? The more I grew to know them both, the more I came to understand how truly different they were. That they had traveled in the same social circles as children, attended virtually interchangeable country day and boarding schools, and been able to navigate the New York subway system, the Paris metro, and the London tube by the time they were 12, said nothing about who they really were as people. It is possible for the same circumstances that draw two souls together to keep them forever at arm's length. Herein lies the truth of love, and the essence of all tragedy. I was not yet wise enough to understand this, nor would I be, until many years had passed. Yet, I believe that from the start I sensed this, and that it was the source of my affinity. the force that pulled me to her. The day of the party arrived. The daylight hours were all desultory preamble. I got nothing done. Was I nervous? How does the bull feel when he is marched into the ring and notices the cheering crowds and the man with his cape and sword? Jonas had gone off for the day, I didn't know where, and as the clock neared 8, the appointed hour, he had yet to show himself. The Midwesterner in me was forever disturbed by the regional differences in what was and was not considered late, and by 9:30, when I decided to dress, I had entertained the girlish fantasy that Jonas and I would do this together. My anxiety was such that it verged on anger. It seemed likely that his promise had been forgotten, and I would spend the evening like a jilted groom, watching TV in a tuxedo. The other difficulty lay in the fact that I did not know how to tie a bow tie. Probably I couldn't have accomplished this in any event. My hands were actually shaking. Managing the studs and cufflinks felt like trying to thread a needle with a hammer. It took me 10 full minutes of cursing like a longshoreman to lodge them in their proper holes, and by the time I was done, my face was damp with sweat. I mopped it away with a bad-smelling towel and examined myself in the full-length mirror on the bathroom door, hoping for some encouragement. I was an unremarkable-looking sort of boy, neither one thing nor the other. Although naturally slender and without significant blemishes, I had always felt my nose was too big for my face, my arms too long for my body, my hair too bulky for the head it sat atop. Yet the face and figure I beheld in the mirror did not look so unpromising to me. The sleek black suit and shiny shoes and starch-hardened shirt, even against my expectations the pink cummerbund, did not appear unnatural on me. Instantly I regretted the powder-blue get-up I'd worn to prom. Who knew that something as simple as a black suit could gentrify one's appearance so thoroughly? For the first time, I dared to think that I, this plain boy from the provinces, might pass through the doors of the Spee Club without an alarm going off. The door sailed open. Jonas charged into the outer room. Fuck, what time is it? He marched straight past me to the bathroom and turned on the shower. I followed him to the door. Where have you been? I said, realizing too late how peevish this sounded. No big deal, but it's almost 10. I had a lab due. He was peeling off his shirt. This thing doesn't really get going until 11. Didn't I tell you? No. Oh. Well, sorry. How do you tie a bow tie? He had stripped to his boxers. Hell if I know. Mine's a clip-on. I retreated to the outer room. Jonas called out over the water, Has Liz been here? Nobody's been here. She was supposed to meet us. My anxiety had now focused entirely on the matter of my tie. I returned to the mirror and withdrew it from my pocket. The gist I'd heard was to tie it like a pair of shoes. How much harder could it be? I'd been tying my own shoes since I was 2. The answer was a lot harder. Nothing I did made the ends come out even close to the same length. It was as if the silk were possessed. Now don't you look spiffy. Liz had come in through the open door, or rather, a woman who resembled Liz. In her place stood a creature of pure, understated glamour. She was wearing a slender black cocktail dress scooped low at the neck and high-heeled shoes of shiny red leather. She had added something to her hair, making it full and rich, and exchanged her glasses for contacts. A long string of pearls, no doubt real, dangled deep into her décolletage. "Wow," I said. "And that," she said, tossing her clutch on the sofa, is the very syllable that every woman longs to hear. A cloud of complex scent had followed her into the room. "Having some troubles with your neckwear, I see." I held out the villainous article. "I have no idea what I'm doing." "Let's have a look." She stepped toward me and took it from my hand. "Ah," she said, examining it. "Here's the problem."
"What?"
"It's a bow tie." She laughed. "As it so happens, you've come to the right person. I do this for my father all the time. Hold still." She draped the tie around my neck and positioned it under the collar. In her heels, she was nearly as tall as I was. Our faces were inches apart. With her eyes intently focused on the base of my throat, she engaged in her mysterious business. I had never been so close to a woman I was not about to kiss. My gaze instinctively went to her lips, which looked soft and warm, then downward, following the path of the pearls. The effect was like a low-voltage current passing through each cell of my body. "Eyes up here, Buster." I knew I was blushing. I looked away.
"Sorry."
"You're a man. What can you do? You're like pool toys. It must be awful." A final adjustment. Then she stepped back. That heat in her cheeks. Was she blushing too? "There you go. Have a look." She retrieved a compact from her clutch and gave it to me. It was made of a material that was smooth to the touch, like polished bone. It felt warm in my hand, as if it were radiating a pure, womanly energy. I opened it, revealing its bay of flesh-toned powder and small round mirror, in which my face looked back at me, floating above the flawlessly knotted pink bow tie. "Perfect," I said. The shower shut off with a groan, widening my awareness. I had forgotten all about my roommate.
"Jonas," Liz called, "we're late."
He bounded into the room, clutching a towel around his waist. I had the feeling of being caught doing something I shouldn't have.
"So are you two going to stand around and watch me dress? Unless..."
Looking at Liz, he gave his towel a suggestive jostle, like an exotic dancer teasing an audience.
"Ça te donne du plaisir, mademoiselle?"
"Just hurry it up. We're late."
"But I asked in French."
"You'll want to work on your accent. We'll meet you outside, thank you very much." She gripped me by the arm, steering me toward the door. "Come on, Tim." We took the stairs to the courtyard. A college campus on a Saturday night follows principles of its own. It awakens just as the rest of the world is readying for slumber. Music came from everywhere, pouring out of the windows. Laughing figures moved through the darkness. Voices lit the night from all directions. As we stepped through the breezeway, a girl hurried past, holding the hem of her dress with one hand, a bottle of champagne in the other. "You'll do fine," Liz assured me. We were standing just beyond the gate. "Do I look worried?" Though of course I was. "All you have to do is act like you belong. That's really the whole point. Of most things, actually." Away from Jonas, she had become somebody slightly different, more philosophical, even a little world-weary. I sensed that this was closer to the truth of her.
"I forgot to mention," Liz said. "I've got somebody I'd like you to meet. She'll be at the party."
I wasn't sure what I thought of this.
"We're cousins," she went on. "Well, second cousins. She goes to BU.
The offer was disorienting. I had to remind myself that what had transpired upstairs had been an innocent flirtation, nothing more, that she was somebody else's girlfriend.
"Okay."
"Try not to sound too excited."
What makes you think we'd hit it off?
The remark came off too blunt, even a little resentful. But if she took offense, she didn't show it. Just don't let her drink too much.
Is that a problem?
She shrugged. Steph can be a bit of a party girl, if you know what I mean. That's her name, Stephanie.
Jonas caught up with us, all grins and apologies. We made our way to the party, which was just 3 blocks away. Previously, he had pointed out the Spee Club building to me, a brick townhouse with a walled side garden I had passed 1,000 times. A college party is usually a loud affair, belching out a wide perimeter of sound. But not this one. There was no evidence that anything was going on inside, and for a second I thought Jonas might have gotten the night wrong. He stepped up to the door and withdrew a single key on a fob from the pocket of his tux. I had seen this key before, lying on his bureau, but had not connected it to anything until now. The fob was in the form of a bear's head, the symbol of the Spee. We followed him inside. We were in an empty foyer, the floor painted in alternating black and white squares like a chessboard. I did not feel as if I were going to a party. Parachuting at night into an alien country was more like it. The spaces I could see were dark and masculine and, for a building inhabited by college students, remarkably neat. A clack of ivory. Nearby, someone was playing pool. On a pedestal in the corner stood a large stuffed bear. Not a teddy bear. An actual bear. It was rearing up on its hind legs, clawed hands reaching forward as if it were going to maul some invisible attacker. That, or play the piano. From overhead came a swell of liquor-loosened voices.
Come on, Jonas said.
He led us back to a flight of stairs. Seen from the street, the building had appeared deceptively modest in its dimensions. But not inside. We ascended toward the noise and heat of the crowd, which had spilled from 2 large rooms onto the landing.
Joe Man!
As we made our entry, Jonas's neck was clamped in the elbow of a large red-haired man in a white dinner jacket. He had the florid complexion and thickened waist of an athlete gone to seed.
Joe Man! Jojo! The Big Joester!
Unaccountably, he gave Jonas a big smooch on the cheek.
And Liz, may I say you were looking especially tasty tonight?
She rolled her eyes. So noted.
Does she love me? I'm asking, does this girl just love me?
With his arms still draped around Jonas, he looked at me with an expression of startled concern.
Sweet Jesus, Jonas, tell me this isn't the guy.
Tim, meet Alcott Spence. He's our president. And roaring drunk, too. So tell me, Tim, you're not gay, are you? Because, no offense, you look a little gay in that tie.
I was caught totally off guard.
Kidding!
He roared with laughter. We were being pressed on all sides now as more partygoers ascended the stairs behind us.
Seriously, I'm just messing with you. Half the guys in here are huge fags. I myself am what you call a sexual omnivore. Isn't that right, Jonas?
He grinned, playing along.
It's true. Jonas here is one of my most special friends. Very special. So you just go ahead and be as gay as you feel you need to be.
Thanks, I said.
But I'm not gay.
Which is also totally fine. That's what I'm saying. Listen to this guy. We're not the Porcellian, you know.
Seriously, those guys cannot stop fucking each other.
How much did I want to drink at that moment? Very, very much.
Well, I've enjoyed our little chat, Alcott merrily continued, but I must be off. Hot date in the sauna with a certain sophomore from the University of Loose Morals and some cocaina mas excelente. You kids run along and have fun.
He faded into the throng. I turned to Jonas.
Is everybody here like that? Actually, no. A lot of them can come on pretty strong.
I looked at Liz. Don't you dare leave me. She laughed wryly.
Are you kidding?
We fought our way to the bar. No lukewarm keg beer here. Behind a long table, a white-shirted bartender was frantically mixing drinks and passing out bottles of Heineken. As he shoveled ice into my vodka tonic, I'd learned my freshman year to stick to clear liquor when I could. I had the urge to send him some clandestine message of Marxist-inspired fellowship. I'm actually from Ohio, I might have told him. I shelve books at the library. I don't belong here any more than you do. P.S. Stand ready. The glorious workers' revolution commences at the stroke of midnight. Yet as he placed the drink in my hand, a new feeling came upon me. Perhaps it was the way he did it. Automatically, like a high-speed robot, his attention already focused to the next partygoer in line. But the thought occurred to me that I'd done it. I'd passed. I had successfully snuck into the other world, the hidden world. This was where I had been headed all along. I gave myself a moment to soak in the sensation. Joining the spee, what I had believed utterly impossible just moments before, suddenly seemed like a fait accompli, a thing of destiny. I would take my place among its membership, because Jonas Lear would pave the way. How else to explain the extraordinary coincidence of our second meeting? Fate had put him in my path for a reason, and here it was, in the rich atmosphere of privilege that radiated from everywhere around me. It was like some new form of oxygen, one I'd been waiting all my life to breathe, and it made me feel weirdly alive. So caught up was I in this new line of thought that I failed to notice Liz standing right in front of me. With her was a new person, a girl. "Tim," she yelled over the music that had erupted in the room behind us. "This is Steph. Pleased to meet you."
"Likewise."
She was short, hazel-eyed, with a spray of freckles and glossy brown hair. Unremarkable compared to Liz, but pretty in her own way. Cute would be the word, and smiling at me in a manner that told me Liz had laid the groundwork. She was holding a nearly empty glass of something clear. Mine was empty, too. Was it my first or my second?
"Liz says you go to BU."
"Yeah."
Because the music was so loud, we were standing very close. She smelled like roses and gin.
"Do you like it?"
"It's okay. You're a biochem major, right?"
I nodded. The most banal conversation in history. But it had to be done.
"What about you?"
"Poli sci. Hey, do you want to dance?"
I was an awful dancer. But who wasn't? We made our way to the light-confettied ballroom and began our awkward attempt to perform this intimate act, pretending we hadn't met each other 30 seconds ago. The dance floor was already full, the music having been strategically withheld until everybody was adequately liquored. I glanced around for Liz, but didn't find her. I supposed she was too cool to make a fool of herself in this way and hoped she didn't see me. Stephanie, not to my surprise, was an enthusiastic dancer. What I hadn't banked on was that she'd be so good at it. Whereas my moves were an ungainly mimicry of actual dancing, wholly unrelated to this song or any other, hers possessed a lithe expressiveness that verged on actual grace. She spun, twirled, gyrated. She did things with her hips that elsewise might have looked indecent, but under the circumstances seemed ordained by a different, less constricted morality. She also managed to keep her attention on me the whole time,
wearing a warmly seductive smile, her eyes focused like lasers. What had Liz called her? A party girl? I was beginning to see the advantages. We broke after the third song for yet another drink, slung them back like sailors on leave, and returned to the floor. I'd eaten no dinner, and the booze was doing its work. The evening dissolved into a haze. At some point, I found myself talking to Jonas, who was introducing me to other members of the club, and then playing pool with Alcott, who was not such a bad fellow after all. Everything I did and said seemed charmed. More time passed, and then Stephanie, whom I'd briefly lost track of, was pulling me by the hand back toward the music, which pumped without ceasing like the night's own heartbeat. I had no idea what time it was, and didn't care. More fast dancing, the song downshifted, and she wrapped her arms around my neck. We'd barely spoken, but now this warm, good-smelling girl was in my arms, her body pressed against mine, the tips of her fingers stroking the hairs at the back of my neck. Never had I received such an undeserved present. What was happening to my anatomy was nothing she could have missed. Nor did I want her to. When the song ended, she placed her lips against my ear, her breath a sweet exhalation that made me shudder. "I have coke." I found myself then, sitting beside her on a deep leather couch in a room that looked like something in a hunting lodge. From her purse, she produced a small packet made of notebook paper, sealed by complex folding. She used my Harvard ID to arrange the coke in two fat lines on the coffee table and rolled a dollar bill into a tube. Cocaine was an aspect of college life that I had not experienced, but did not see the harm of. She bent to the table, sucked the powder deep into her sinuses with a delicate, girlish snort, and passed me the bill so that I might do the same. It wasn't bad at all. It was, in fact, very good. Within seconds of the powder's purchase, I experienced a Roman candle rush of well-being that seemed not a departure from reality, but a deeper entry into truth. The world was a fine place full of wonderful people, an enchanted existence worthy of the utmost enthusiasm. I looked at Stephanie, who was quite beautiful now that I had eyes to see, and sought the words to explain this revelation on a night of many. "You're a really good dancer," I said. She leaned forward and took my mouth with hers. It was not a schoolgirl's kiss. It was a kiss that said there were no rules if I didn't want there to be. It did not take long before our bodies were a confusion of tongues and hands and skin. Things were being slid aside, unlatched, unzipped. I felt like I had plummeted into a vortex of pure sensuality. It was different than it had been with Carmen. It had no edges, no roughness. It felt like being melted. Stephanie was astride my lap and drawing her panties aside, and down she went, enveloping me. She began to move in a wondrous, aquatic fashion, like an anemone undulating on the tides, rocking and rising and plunging, each variation accompanied by the creak of leather upholstery. Mere hours since I'd been pacing my room, consigned to a night of humiliated loneliness, and here I was, fucking a girl in a cocktail dress. "Whoa, sorry, bud." It was Jonas. Stephanie was off me like a shot, a moment of frantic activity as the pants were yanked upward, the dress downward, various articles of underclothing rammed into adjustment. Standing in the doorway, my roommate was in a state of barely contained hilarity. "Jesus," I said,
I was pulling up my fly, or trying to. My shirt tail was stuck in the zipper. More comedy.
You could have knocked.
And you could have locked the door.
Jonas, did you find her?
Liz appeared behind him. As she stepped into the room, her eyes widened.
Oh,
she said.
They were getting better acquainted,
Jonas offered, laughing. Stephanie was smoothing down her hair. Her lips were swollen, her face flushed with blood. I had no doubt mine was the same.
I can see that, Liz said.
Her mouth was set in a prim line. She didn't look at me.
Steph, your friends are waiting for you outside. Unless you want me to tell them something else.
This was clearly impossible. The balloon of passion had been punctured.
No, I guess I should go.
She fetched her shoes from the floor and turned to me. I was ridiculously still sitting on the sofa.
Well, thanks, she said. It was really nice to meet you.
Should we kiss? Shake hands? What was I supposed to say? Your welcome didn't seem like it would cut it. In the end, the gap between us was too wide. We didn't even touch.
You too, I said.
She followed Liz from the room. I felt miserable, not only because of my painfully blockaded loins, but also because of Liz's unmistakable disappointment in me. I had revealed myself to be just like every other guy, a pure opportunist.
It wasn't until that moment that I fully realized how important her opinion of me had become.
Where is everybody? I asked Jonas. The building was remarkably quiet.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning. Everybody's gone. Except for Alcott. He's passed out in the pool room.
I looked at my watch.
So it was.
Whether from the adrenaline or the coke counteracting the booze, my thoughts had cleared. Cringe-inducing snippets of the night came back to me. Knocking a drink onto a member's date, attempting a Cossack dance to the B-52's Love Shack, laughing too loudly at a joke that was actually somebody's sad story about his disabled brother. What had I been thinking, getting so drunk?
Are you okay? You want us to wait?
I'd never wanted anything less in my life. I was already calculating which park bench I could sleep on.
Did people do that anymore?
You guys go ahead. I'll be along.
Don't worry about Liz, if that's what you're thinking. This was totally her idea.
It was?
Jonas shrugged.
Well, maybe not that you'd actually bone her cousin on the couch. But she wanted you to feel, I don't know, included.
This made me feel even worse. Stupidly, I had assumed that Liz was doing her cousin a favor when it was the other way around.
Listen, Tim, I'm sorry.
Forget it, I said, and waved my roommate away.
I'm fine, really. Go home.
I waited 10 minutes, gathered myself together, and left the building. Jonas hadn't said where he and Liz were going. Back to her place, probably. But I couldn't chance it. I made my way down to the river and began to walk. I had no destination in mind. I suppose I was performing a kind of penance, though for what precisely I could not say. I had, after all, done exactly what was expected of me by the standards of that time and place. Gray dawn found me, a pathetic figure in his tuxedo, 5 miles away on the Longfellow Bridge overlooking the Charles River Basin. The first rowers were out, carving the waters with their long, elegant oars. It is at such moments that revelations are said to come. But none did. I had wanted too much and embarrassed myself. There wasn't anything more to say than that. I was badly hungover,
Blisters had formed on both feet from my too-tight shoes. The thought occurred to me that I hadn't spoken to my father in a very long time, and I was sorry about that, though I knew I would not call him. By the time I got back to Winthrop, it was nearly 9 o'clock. I keyed the lock and found Jonas freshly shaved and sitting on his bed, shoving his legs into a pair of jeans.
"Jesus, look at you," he said. "Did you get mugged or something?"
I went for a walk. Everything about him radiated cheerful urgency.
"What's going on?"
"We're leaving is what's going on."
He got to his feet, shoving his shirt into the waistband of his jeans.
"You better change."
"I'm exhausted. I'm not going anywhere."
"Better rethink that. Alcott just phoned. We're driving down to Newport."
I had no idea what to make of this ridiculous claim. Newport was at least 2 hours away. All I wanted to do was climb into my bed and sleep.
"What are you talking about?" Jonas snapped on his watch and stepped to the mirror to brush his hair, still damp from the shower. "The after party. Just members and punchees this time. The ones who, you know, passed.
Which would include you, my friend."
"You're joking."
"Why would I joke about a thing like that?"
"Gee, I don't know. Maybe because I made a total jackass of myself?"
He laughed.
"Don't be so hard on yourself. You got a little wasted, so what? Everybody really liked you, especially Alcott. Apparently, your escapade in the library made quite an impression."
My stomach dropped.
"He knows?
Are you serious? Everybody knows. It's Alcott's house we're going to, by the way. You should see this place. It's like something in a magazine."
He turned from the mirror.
"Earth to Fanning. Am I talking to myself here?"
I guess not."
"Then for fuck's sake, get dressed."
17. The fall was a marathon of parties, each more extravagant than the last. Nights at restaurants I could never afford, strip clubs, a harbor cruise on a 60-foot boat owned by an alumnus who never came out of his cabin. Bit by bit, the candidates dropped away, until only a dozen remained. Just after the Thanksgiving holiday, an envelope appeared under my door. I was to report to the club at midnight. Alcott met me in the entryway, instructed me not to speak, and handed me a pewter cup of powerful rum, which he told me to down. The building seemed empty. All the lights were out. He led me to the library, blindfolded me, and told me to wait. Some minutes passed. I was feeling quite drunk, and having trouble maintaining my balance. Then I heard, from behind me, an alarming sound, a low animal growling, like a dog about to attack. I spun, stumbling, and whipped off the blindfold as the bear reared up before me. It seized me bodily, hurled me to the ground, and pounced on top of me, pushing the wind from my chest. In the dark room, all I could make out was its great black bulk and gleaming teeth poised above my neck. I screamed, utterly convinced that I was about to die. A prank, intended to be harmless, had obviously gone terribly wrong. Until I realized that the bear, rather than tearing my throat open, had begun to hump me. The lights came on. It was Alcott, wearing a bear suit. All the members were there, including Jonas. An explosion of general hilarity, and then the champagne came out. I had been accepted. The dues were $110 a month, more than I had to spare, less than I could do without. I signed on for extra hours at the library and found I could make up the difference easily enough. I had spent Thanksgiving at Jonas's house in Beverly, But Christmas was a problem. I had told him nothing about my situation, and did not want to be the object of his pity. A semester of non-stop parties had also put me badly behind in my studies. I was at a loss as to what to do until I hit upon the idea of calling Mrs. Chodorow, the woman whose house I had lived in for the summer. She agreed to let me stay, even offered to let me have my room for free. It would be nice, she said, to have a young person around for the holidays. On Christmas Eve, she invited me downstairs, and the two of us passed the afternoon together, baking cookies for her church and watching the Yule log on TV. She'd even bought me a present, a pair of leather gloves. I had thought I was immune to holiday sentiment, but I was so touched that my eyes actually welled with tears. It wasn't until February that I decided to call Stephanie. I felt bad about what had happened and had meant to apologize sooner, but the longer I'd waited, the more difficult this had become. I assumed that she'd just hang up on me, but she didn't. She seemed genuinely happy to hear from me. I asked her if she wanted to meet for coffee, and the two of us discovered that, even sober, we liked each other. We kissed under an awning in the falling snow, a much different kind of kiss, shy, almost courtly. And then I put her in a cab to Back Bay, and when I returned to my room, the phone was already ringing. Thus were the terms established for the next 2 years of my life. Somehow, the universe had forgiven me my trespasses, my vain ambitions, my casual, self-interested cruelties. I should have been happy, and for the most part was. The four of us, Liz and Jonas, Stephanie and I, became a quartet. Parties, movies, weekend ski trips to Vermont, and lusty, drunken outings to Cape Cod, where Liz's family had a house left conveniently unoccupied during the off-season. I did not see Stephanie during the week, nor did Jonas see much of Liz, whose life did not seem otherwise to intersect with his own, and the rhythms appeared to work. From Monday to Friday, I worked my tail off. Come Friday night, the fun began. My grades were excellent, and my professors took notice. I was encouraged to begin thinking about where I would pursue my doctoral work. Harvard was at the top of my list, but there were other considerations. My advisor was lobbying for Columbia, the chairman of the department for Rice, where he had taken his PhD and still had close professional connections. I felt like a racehorse up for auction, but hardly minded. I was in the gate. Soon the bell would ring, and I would commence my mad dash down the track. Then Lucchesi killed himself. This was in the summer. I'd remained in Cambridge, staying at Mrs. Chodorow's, and had resumed working at the lab. I hadn't spoken to Lucchesi since the last day of our freshman year. Indeed, had barely thought of him beyond a mild curiosity, never acted on, as to his fate. It was his sister, Ariana, who telephoned me. How she'd tracked me down, I didn't think to ask. She was clearly in shock. Her voice was flat and emotionless, laying out the fact. Lucchesi had been working in a video store. He appeared, at first, to have taken his expulsion more or less in stride. The experience had chastened but not broken him. There were vague plans about his attending the local community college, perhaps reapplying to Harvard in a year or two. But across the winter and spring, his tics had gotten worse. He became sullen and uncommunicative, refusing to talk to anyone for days. The low-grade muttering became more or less continual, as if he were engaged in conversation with imaginary persons. A number of disturbing obsessions took hold. He would spend hours reading the daily newspaper, underlining random sentences in wholly unrelated articles, and claimed that the CIA was watching him. Gradually, it became apparent that he was in the throes of a psychotic episode, perhaps even full-blown schizophrenia. His parents made arrangements to have him admitted to a psychiatric hospital, but the night before he was to leave, he disappeared. Apparently, he had taken the train to Manhattan. With him, in a canvas bag, was a length of sturdy rope. In Central Park, he had selected a tree with a large rock beneath its boughs, flung the rope over one of the branches, put the noose in place, and stepped off. The distance was not enough to break his neck. He could have regained a foothold on the boulder at any time. But such was his determination that he hadn't done this, and death had been caused by slow strangulation. A horrendous detail I wished Ariana had not shared with me. In his pocket was a note. Call Fanning. The funeral was scheduled for the following Saturday. Under the circumstances, the family wanted to proceed quietly, with a brief service confined to close family and friends. That I was to be among them was ordained by his note, although I told Ariana that I didn't know what to make of it, which was true. We'd been friends, but not great friends. Our bond had hardly gone deep enough to earn my inclusion in his final thoughts. I wondered if he intended this note as a punishment of some kind, though I could not think what sin I had committed to warrant it. The other possibility was that he was sending me a message of an altogether different nature, that his death was, in a way only he could understand, a demonstration for my benefit. But what it could mean, I hadn't the foggiest. Jonas was spending the summer on an archaeological dig in Tanzania. Stephanie had won a coveted internship in Washington, working on Capitol Hill, but at the time of Lucchesi's death was traveling with her parents in France and could not be reached. I did not think that Lucchesi's death had shaken me all that badly. But of course it had. My emotions, like Ariana's, were blunted by shock. Yet I showed the good sense to call the one person I trusted whom I could actually get on the phone. Liz's family was on the Cape, but she was working at a bookshop in Connecticut. "I'm sorry about your friend," she said. "You shouldn't be alone. Meet me at Grand Central at the main kiosk, the one with the four-faced clock." My train got into Penn Station early Friday morning. I took the one train uptown to 42nd Street, changed to the 7, and arrived at Grand Central at the height of the rush. Except to change buses at Port Authority in the middle of the night, I had never been to New York City, and as I ascended the ramp into the terminal's main concourse, I was, like many a traveler through the ages, bowled over by the majesty of its dimensions. I felt as though I'd entered the grandest of cathedrals, not some mere way station, but a destination in its own right, worthy of pilgrimage. Even the tiniest sound seemed magnified by the sheer size of the place. The smoke-stained ceiling, with its images of constellated stars, soared so majestically overhead it seemed to rewrite the dimensions of the world. Liz was waiting for me at the kiosk, wearing a light summer dress and carrying an overnight bag. She hugged me far longer and more tightly than I was prepared for, and it was in the shelter of her embrace that I suddenly felt the weight of Lucchesi's death, like a cold stone at the center of my chest. "We're staying at my parents' apartment in Chelsea," she said. "I won't take no for an answer." We took a cab downtown, through streets clogged with traffic and great walls of pedestrians that surged forward at every intersection. This was early 1990s New York, a time when the city seemed on the verge of unmanageable chaos, and although I was later in life to live in a very different Manhattan, safe, tidy, and affluent, my first impression of the city was so indelible, so charged with heat and light, that it remains my truest vision of the place. The apartment was on the second floor of a brownstone just off 8th Avenue. Two small rooms, compactly furnished, with a view across 28th Street of a small theater known for incomprehensible avant-garde productions and a men's haberdashery called World of Shirts and Socks. Liz had explained that her parents only used the place when they came into the city to shop or take in a show. Probably nobody had been there in months. The funeral was at 10 the next morning. I called Ariana to tell her where I was staying, and she said that she'd arrange for a car to meet us in the morning and drive us to Riverdale. There was no food in the apartment, so Liz and I went up the street to a small cafe with tables on the sidewalk. She told me what she knew of Jonas, which wasn't very much. She'd received only 3 letters, none very long. I'd never quite understood what he was doing there. He was a biologist, or wanted to be, not an archaeologist, though I knew it had to do with extracting fossilized pathogens from the bones of early hominids. Basically, she said, he's squatting in the dirt all day long, dusting rocks with a paintbrush. Sounds like fun. Oh, to him it is. I knew this to be so. Sharing a room with the man had taught me that, despite his fun-loving exterior, Jonas was deeply serious about his studies, sometimes verging toward obsession. The core of his passion lay in the idea that the human animal was a truly unique organism, evolutionarily distinct. Our powers of reason, of language, of abstract thought, none of these was matched anywhere else in the animal kingdom. Yet, despite these gifts, we remained chained to the same physical limitations as every other creature on the earth. We were born, we aged, we died, all of it in a relatively short span of time. From an evolutionary point of view, he said, this simply made no sense. Nature craved balance, yet our brains were completely out of sync with the short shelf life of the bodies that housed them. Think about it, he said. What would the world be like if human beings could live 200 years, 500, how about 1,000? What leaps of genius would a man be capable of, with a millennium of accumulated wisdom on which to draw? The great mistake of modern biological science, he believed, was to assume that death was natural when it was anything but, and to view it in terms of isolated failures of the body. Cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, diabetes. Trying to cure them one by one, he said, was as pointless as swatting at a swarm of bees. You might get a couple, but the swarm would kill you in the end. The key, he said, lay in confronting the whole question of death, to turn it on its head. Why should we have to die at all? Could it be that somewhere within the deep molecular coding of our species lay the roadmap to a next evolutionary step, one in which our physical attributes would be brought into equilibrium with our powers of thought? And wouldn't it make sense that nature, in its genius, intended for us to discover this for ourselves, employing the unique endowments it had afforded us? He was, in short, making a case for immortality as the apotheosis of the human state. This sounded like mad science to me, The only things missing from his argument were a slab of reassembled body parts and a lightning rod, and I'd told him as much.